My name is Billy Beck. I really appreciate you all attending today. I'm with Iowa State University, Department of Natural Resource, Ecology, and Management, Ames, Iowa. This is my second Tri-Societies meeting, so I'm very excited and very grateful that I'm allowed to speak here today, so thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about a project that I'm involved with. For today, we're going to be looking at suspended sediment and total phosphorus contributions from three pretty distinct alluvial deposits that were laid down during the Holocene in Iowa from the past 10,000 years. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors and funding sources real quick. So in the American Midwest, stream bank erosion is this ubiquitous sight. It's everywhere. I could just remember from being just even a little kid, I remember walking through these massive, just eroded rivers. Obviously, in Iowa, we care about these this bank erosion because of sediment contributions to the waterway, habitat degradation, reservoir sedimentation, and whatnot. But as time goes on, we're really starting to look at the phosphorus associated with this soil, the sediments that are eroded into the banks here. An example of this is the IRA nutrient reduction strategy recently crafted. It's calling for a 45% reduction in total P loads, but there's no in-channel or stream bank component. So we really don't have a complete grasp on what's going on with P in the channel as of now. But hopefully studies like this will help further versions of that. And of course, obviously in the literature, there is evidence that these banks may be a significant source of phosphorus loads. So the overall project, which I won't cover all of it today, essentially is, in my head, we're looking for phosphorus hotspots. Sources and sinks in the watershed. We want to go into a watershed and be able to say, okay, where's the phosphorus coming from? Where is it being stored? And then also, after it erodes into the stream, what is happening with, or what soil characteristics and what water column conditions may make phosphorus act differently, say, attach or detach to sediments? The kind of overall hypothesis of this is that sediments contribute differently the amount and forms of P after they are eroded into the stream. And for, former PhD student Soroso Rahutomo, who's now Dr. Rahutomo, he did a lot of the soil chemistry with this, looking at all kinds of soil characteristics, equilibrium P concentration, phosphorus buffering capacity, redox pH, all these factors that might influence how P behaves when it gets into the system. Essentially looking at where it's coming from, where is it being stored, and then what conditions of the water column and the soil characteristics themselves lead to excessive phosphorus loads. So today I just want to introduce the watershed. I introduce you to the Holocene alluvial deposits and then kind of get into our sediment, what we're seeing so far as far as sediment and total phosphorus contributions. I'll just go through our methods and preliminary results. For today, I'm just looking at water years 15 and water year 16 up to about August. So. Walnut Creek watersheds in central Iowa, beautiful central Iowa. Very interesting place to work. I'm really glad that I couldn't really have asked for a better place to look at phosphorus is a situation like this. Is we've primarily got a very intensely agricultural headwater system. And then here in the red is our study channel, the portion of the channel we're looking at. And really, it runs through the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, which has been restored, bulk of it has been restored, from row crop to native tallgrass prairie since the early 90s. So it's a very interesting contrast to look at phosphorus and sediment in this kind of situation here. It's about 5,200 hectares. We've got pre-Illinois and drift overlain by about 2 to 6 meters of a lus cap. And then the really great thing about Walnut is we've got water quality data going back from 1995, from two gauging stations run by ARS at the upper and lower portions of the watershed. So really, really great place to be. If you've never been there, I highly recommend going. If you're ever in central Iowa and look for something to do, it's this gem in the midst of some of the most intensive agriculture you'll ever witness. So it's really neat. Real quick about the hydrology of the system, because I think this has a lot to do with where and when sediments are being eroded. It's incredibly flashy. We've channelized it, a lot of salt child drainage, land cover alterations. This is a photo from summer 15. This was a flow event that had happened maybe about a week earlier. It's already back down to my knee level here. So these events are in and out of this watershed incredibly fast. It's very, very flashy. And my point with this is that, a lot of these stream banks are just not subjected to the actual fluvial erosion that often. So I think that has something to do with, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Good deal of channel incision. This is our ladder we use to measure stream banks. So out of bank flows and the fluvial erosion at this upper areas here is just, it's very rare. Maybe once or twice a year, maybe. So. All right. Well, the banks at Walnut are made up of three very, very distinct, I'll call them members for the rest of the talk, alluvial, Holocene alluvial deposits. Three of these deposits, and then we're going to be also looking at colluvial material as well in the bank. Start off here, the Gunder member is the base. This also, in many parts, forms the actual stream bed itself. This was laid down about 10,500, about 3,500 years before present. It was a time when it was a wet, cool climate. Deciduous forest dominated in Iowa, if you can imagine that. And very, very high flow events. Next, we have the Roberts Creek member. And in this photo, it's buried. You can just see it peeking out here. But this was about 3,500, about 500 years ago. The climate was a little bit drier, warmer. So prairie was dominating Iowa at this point. And above, and this always amazes me, above from my hand up, is all the post-European settlement alluvium that has come down from the uplands after we had the, you know, less than perfect farming practices of the early century. And that can be up to a meter and a half thick in some spots. And also, I think very, very important is we're looking at this colluvial material that builds up at the bank toe and how that is the erosive characteristics of that as well. Here's another different picture. This is more of a raw bank, no colluvial material except for this little bit down here. So you can really see it's like nice little layer cake here. You got the Gunder, the Roberts, and the Camp Creek member. So going in order here, this is Camp Creek, the top bank portion. Mid-bank is the Roberts Creek, and lower the base, and even the base of the channel itself, is the Gunder. Camp's the silt loam. It's got the highest silt content. Weak, granular structure. When it's dry, it just crumbles to dust in your hand. The Roberts has a nice blocky structure, very dark in color, nice organic matter, silty clay loam. It also has the highest clay content of the three. And the Gunder is this structureless, massive, just kind of cohesive mass. It's very plastic. This has the highest sand content of the three. This is also very, very, very dense. If you're just thinking about factors that influence erodibility, just kind of throwing up some of the members' characteristics here. Bulk density, the Gunder is the densest at 1.6, and obviously the colluvial is the least dense, 1.2 grams per centimeter cubed. Camp Creek has the highest silt content, obviously silt, very erodible. And then critical shear stress, the actual force of the flowing water that it takes to entrain the material from the bank. Lazell and Mandel did a really neat study in 2014 looking at what the critical shear stress was of these members. They didn't look at Roberts Creek or colluvial, but they did it Camp and Gunder. Obviously Gunder, very, very more, much more resistant to erosion than the Camp Creek member. So those are some factors that you think about when you think about terms of erodibility. As far as phosphorus, total phosphorus concentration per member, we went out last fall and sampled all these. If you picture the stream bank, this is kind of what a typical stream bank looks like. You got your Camp Creek, the Roberts Creek, big mass of colluvial, and the Gunder at the base. So Camp Creek's got the lowest TP concentration, and I haven't run stats on this, so I'm not sure there's any significant differences here. As you can see, it goes down to the Gunder about 300 or so milligrams per kilogram. I wanted to mention the processes that are going on in this watershed, too, as far as erosion. I think that has a big factor on what we're seeing sediment and phosphorus-wise. This picture, I like this picture a lot. We've got two processes going on here. The first, which I think is one of the more important factors in the watershed, we have these subaerial processes going on up here on these exposed stream banks. In the winter, it's freeze-thaw. In the summer, it's wet-dry. And it just forces the soil to kind of crumble off and build up at the bank toe here. So all this colluvial material builds up, and then just waiting for a rise in stage so that fluvial erosion can kind of take over and whisk this away. So subaerial driven erosion, fluvial erosion here at the base. And you can see the Gunder member poking out here. And this is all kind of a loose colluvial material covering up the Roberts and part of the camp. Again, this is another typical bank. We've got the Roberts Creek right here, or the Camp Creek right here, the Roberts Creek kind of barely poking out, and then all colluvium down to the bank toe. Again, this is after a recent, I think this is the day after a snowstorm, and it's already going. This colubrium's already fallen down from the Camp Creek member into the snow. So I think subaerial is something I'd like to look into further, this subaerial-driven erosion. So. All right. The other big factor in Walnut Creek is mass movements, when the whole bank just goes. So this is we have a time-lapse camera out there. This is a fridge for reference. It wouldn't be the Midwest if there wasn't a kitchen appliance in the stream. So this is spring of this year. You can see the whole bank just going in like that. So that's another big factor. We just get these mass movements. And then at the bottom, fluvial erosion takes over again. So our methods, real quick, for this piece of the study, we're looking at quantifying erosion using bank erosion pins, or just simply a metal rod inserted into the bank. We come back every month or after every big flow event, see how much of the pin is exposed. That gives us an idea of aggradation or degradation. We've got 61 total stream banks up and down Walnut Creek. A neat thing we are doing is we're looking at comparing the pin measurements to the LIDAR, ground-based terrestrial LIDAR, to see if they link up in any way. So LIDAR is nice, it's easy, but it's expensive. Bank pins are kind of a pain in the neck, but they're fairly cheap. So, and they're arranged in a grid here, and the grid, obviously, we're trying to target the different members so we can get an idea of how they're eroding. Here we go again. This is in the Camp Creek member. You can see the striations here on the little flood events. But one important thing that we do when we measure pins is at that pin interface, we record what member is present at that pin interface. That gives us that allows us to track per pin, so we're kind of tracking per pin, the different erosion rates of each member, colluvium, Roberts, and Gunder. So we're tracking each pin. Gives us a pretty good idea of what's going on as far as the members' recession rate and the volume they're providing to the channel. We also go out and we basically make a map of the bank faces. We do a grid. We want to establish a surface area that each member represents, that it's exposed to the flowing water. So, for example, 70% is colluvial surface area, you know, something like that. So with this surface area, we can get the actual surface area of the potentially erodible, or the eroding soil, and then we've got the recession rates from the pin, and that can give us a volume that each member is putting into the stream each year. All right, so some quick figures here. If you look, again, this is just like the bank would be. You got Camp on top, Roberts, Colluvial, and Gunder. You can see that for the whole erodible portion of the stream banks in Walnut Creek, colluvial really dominates the surface area, that exposed portion exposed to the water. Almost 80 to 90% of that surface area is colluvial material. Only minor exposure from Camp Creek, Roberts Creek, and then the Gunder. This is for water years 16 and 15. Again, how much SSC or suspended sediment is being provided by these members? Again, colluvial dominates with minor contributions from the other three members. So we're looking at colluvial in 15, about 25-27% of the total suspended sediment load came from colluvial material. As far as total phosphorus, we're still cranking on getting the total phosphorus loads. So right now I'm just going to share what those members have been contributing. And again, no surprise, the colluvial material is giving the largest contribution to the in-stream loads of total phosphorus, about 300 to 400 kilograms per year, and minor from the rest. Just tending to the conclusions, the colluvial material tends to dominate both the surface area of the banks out there that are eroding, and also the suspended sediment concentration and total phosphorus loads. That's the dominant source, is this colluvial material that's falling down and building up at the bank toe. And then really, I think stratigraphy matters. Position on the bank really affects what erosion processes are impacting these different members and how they're contributing to TP and SSC loads. So really like to start looking into the subaerial driven erosion in the future. So yeah, again, those processes are very important. I got a lot of great people to thank. There's too many to list, but thank you so much, ARS, University of Iowa Fish and Wildlife. So, my favorite mulberry tree. So thank you so much. I appreciate you attending, sir. I guess if you're interested, I do post a lot on Twitter about our team's progress in the field. So if y'all are interested in Iowa stream bank erosion, that's, you can get right there. So, yes. Sorry, the what? Could you repeat that?
Yeah, the scholar.
Yeah, the Oh, yes.
The
yes, the question was, do we have data on the channel scour? We do. We have a lot. And it's, we've got some going back to 1998, and we have channel cross-sections scattered throughout the watershed that we've compared from 1998. We got a set from 2004, and we have a recent set from 2015. So if you're familiar with the channel evolution model, in a nutshell, the channel is still getting deeper and wider as time goes on. So, yep. Sure.
You categorize colluvium separately from the member layers, but it's obviously coming from them. So
correct.
How do you attribute that to one or more of the members? I mean, how do you separate it? Because it's loose and
correct. I mean, it's going to be tricky. If you really want to get down to it, we could look at some kind of maybe isotope or soil characteristics. But when we go and take that pin reading, it's pretty visually apparent if it's the member or not. We consider the member as if you can 100% identify it. If it's pretty vertical and it's still in that solid state, whereas the colluvium is very loose. So I guess to answer your question, it's visual when we're out in the field. So, and then by texturing. So.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.